Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Today, host Keith Brownell talks with Frederick Martin about his book, After Conviction, What You Can Do Before a Lawyer is Appointed. His book details what can be done by those who have been falsely convicted to aid in their own appeals process. Then, host Melvin Merritt talks with author Martin Henn about his book, Under the Color of Law, and the ASPA, which is American Services Members Protection Act. Henn will make the case the ASPA violates the balance of powers between the branches of government and international law. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next is Keith Brownell and his guest.
Good morning and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownell, and today on our program, we have in the studio Mr. Frederick Martin, who recently published a booklet known as or entitled After the Conviction. He's going to explain to us what that book is about, and I would encourage everyone who is incarcerated and in the listening distance of our broadcast to pay very close attention. Good morning, Fred. Morning. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you this morning, Keith?
Oh, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm free, so I'm not incarcerated.
Yeah, for both of us. You're right.
I also want to point out that Brother Fred, he's spent over 50 years, half a decade of his life being incarcerated. And I'm am I correct in assuming that this is partially what inspired you to try to put this booklet together?
Right, it is. It is. Okay. Because while I was down, you know, like I'd say about 90% of the people that's locked up, you know, you don't have the money, you don't have the resources, don't have the information, and you just kind of like stuck, mm-hmm. you know. So wanting to do something for myself, I decided to learn something.
And you talked to me earlier about you said, your mother did that, was doing a lot of those bits with you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you go in a little more detail and elaborate about that, about the impact that incarceration has on family members, because I don't think it's enough attention that's paid to that on a regular basis.
You know, it's like when a person is arrested and go away, it don't affect them by themselves. It's like a ripple effect. People that care about you, people that love you, even sometimes people that don't even know you, and people that don't, probably some people don't even like you. It affects them too. I mean, because some people say, like, he got a bad deal, got a raw deal. But your family members, the ones that love you, they suffer just as much as you because you're torn away from them. You know, and then, like, they feel helpless because they feel like we don't know what to do to help you. And then that more or less compounds how you feel at the same time. While I was doing my various bits in different states and federal system, you know, my mom was there, you know, so sometimes your partners be there and sometimes they don't, but your family's always there, you know, and the love they have, you have to look at the pain you cause them too. And once you realize that ripple effect is actually hurting them, you know, it should motivate you to do something better for yourself.
And, you know, it's been my experience that when I've talked to people who incarcerate, a lot of times they feel that they've been abandoned by their family members because they don't try to communicate with them or stay in touch with them or try to go through the situations that they have to experience every day. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of times that it's too painful on the family members.
Right, right. And, you know, sometimes it's like they hurt and don't know how to express it, just like we do. We hurt, we don't know how to express it. And so the times that we do express it don't be in a proper manner. Mm-hmm. You always have to understand your family do love you, but your family have lives they have to continue also.
Exactly.
And when you locked up, their life don't stop. You know, they have to pay the bills. They have to go to school, go to work, fix dinner, wash clothes, all the stuff that you used to be able to do with them. You're not able to do it with them anymore. Mm-hmm. Your children are growing up. Your wife or your husband, you know, they out there and part of them is gone just because you gone.
Exactly.
You know, so it's, you know, it's, I don't think families are abandoned. Mm-hmm. The families that don't mess with people, I think it's because the person inside has burnt that bridge.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of times, you know, we can't blame other people for what we do.
Exactly.
You know, because it starts with us and it ripples out to them.
Exactly.
You know, so
Okay, can you talk a little bit more in detail about this book, this booklet, and, you know, how you came to start being motivated to put this literature together?
Well, we're not going too much into my case because it's in the book. I had a charge, and I believe that the reason why I was charged the way I was because of I have a history. And then I was wrongly convicted. I was overcharged, and I was wrongly convicted. So, but besides that, I'm sitting in prison, and I don't have money. You know, I didn't have the type of money that I knew that probably would have got me out. Didn't have it available, and I didn't have the proper information that I needed. So I had to learn. So the money I did have, I bought the books, I did the studying, and I put in the work to try to learn. But I'm in prison with like. In the area I was in are like 2,000 other people. We all in the same position. None of us know. So when I started learning, and God blessed me to understand what I was reading, I put it into notes and stuff, and the notes turned into this book.
Well, do you feel like you was targeted by the system when you acquired these other convictions that led to you going to prison?
I think when I put myself in a position, that made me a target. You know, I think like, that there is some targeting against minorities or poor people. I won't just say minorities because you might think just black people. No, but right. You have poor whites, poor Mexicans, poor anybody else, you know. And the person that is poor, you're always going to be victim because we're not only poor financially, we're poor educationally, morally, mentally, sport. You know, we just without the natural things that we need in order to sustain our life on a livable plane. So because that sometimes we make not so good decisions. And because of not so good decisions, then of course the system is there waiting for us. We get snared up.
What age were you when you were first incarcerated?
I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a teenager.
And what age were you when you decided that you had to be done with this, that you couldn't allow this to happen in your life anymore?
I think I was in my 50s.
Yeah. And so you, what advice can you give to other people about being motivated to try to work on their cases? I mean, do you feel like a lot of people would be less people in prison, there would be less convictions in a lot of cases if people took the initiative to familiarize themselves with the law and avoid some of the traps that's set for people who actually don't know how to navigate through the system?
Yeah, you know, like, that. You know, I was in the streets a long time, and that was a saying that we used to have, you know, you can't play the game if you don't know the rules.
Right.
You know, so, and that applies, like, in life, you know, and most of the times we just don't know, and what we don't know hurts us. What we don't know can kill us.
Exactly.
You know, so we have to, like, educate ourselves. We have to learn how to read. We have to learn how to experience the different things. We have to be able to be motivated to do different things. Now, for the people in prison, I say, like, when you're in prison and you have all this pent-up energy, you go out, you work out, you play ball, you get involved in groups and organizations inside the prison. But the main focus in prison for me was to get out.
Exactly.
You know, just to get out. And I found that by me having the sentence that I had, the door was almost closed. You know, so I had to learn to find the key that would open one of the doors or at least give me a little bit of relief. You know, so I started reading, and I come to find out that I didn't know nothing about the law because I didn't know the rules. I didn't know the statutes. I didn't know the procedures. So I spent years reading about the rules, the procedures, and what's supposed to be done, what's allowed and what's not allowed. And from the experience that I have gained going through the school of hard knocks, I put in the book because I don't think everybody should go through the same thing I went through.
You know, I can identify with what you were saying because, like, I think when I went to prison, I was a teenager as well.
Right.
And I came through the door trying to learn whatever I could about the law. It wasn't a lot of resources available then. Like, I came in prison in the early 70s, and you didn't have this prisoners' rights revolution until, you know, the end of the 70s, somewhere in the 80s and stuff.
Right.
That's when the courts started handing down a lot of rulings telling prisons that they had to have law libraries and stuff of that nature. When I was incarcerated, in my earlier years, all they you asked them for some legal books, all they had was a copy of the Missouri Revised Statutes. And right. I didn't, at that time, I wasn't even aware that they had all these volumes and volumes of other books that you had. Right. And even at me coming in prison at an early age, it took me years before I got to the point where I felt like I was confident in being able to maneuver myself through the criminal justice system. Right. If I hadn't took the time to learn the things that I learned, mm-hmm. I got caught up in different situations from time to time in prison that probably would have resulted in me never being able to get out again.
Right.
You know, but I was able to navigate myself through those systems, and I was glad that I took the time to acquaint myself with that. And I said all that to say is that I think a lot of people, when they come to prison and they're young, they don't want to spend all that time trying to familiarize themselves with the law and all that. They go in there and they look and they see all these books in the library. They open them and they say, oh, man, that's too much. I can't deal
right,
with that.
Right.
The thing that taught me is that when I first got to prison, I had this guy. He was supposed to be a jailhouse lawyer. He was following me around
telling
me, oh, I'll get you out of prison. I'll get you out of prison. I said, well, how much is it going to cost? He said, give me five cards of cigarettes.
Right.
I gave him five cards of cigarettes. He threw some crap together, man. I sent my stuff to court and he sent it back. It was denied the next week.
Right.
And it messed up my case. Well, right. You know, I couldn't really get it because once you put something in court, if it ain't right, you know, they don't want to hear nothing else a lot of times. So I learned then. I had to go and learn this stuff myself. I had to put the time and work in it. And, you know, I guess what you have prepared is helpful because it's not a very thick booklet.
Right.
You know, a person could sit down and look at it and probably can learn a lot out of it and maybe go over it and maybe a couple. I probably have to read it a few times over and over again, but it could get you started in trying to learn what you need to learn. Once you start learning, you actually become eager to learn more.
Right.
You
right.
develop a thirst of knowledge.
Right.
And so, you know, I hope that what you have written, I hope it would steer brothers in that direction. Now, how or people, period. Now, how does this book distinguish itself from some of the other books like the Prisoner Self-Help Litigation Manual, which has been around for years, it's pretty right. thick, and things like that? How is your booklet different from that?
Well, this book is distinguished because it deals only with post-conviction remedies, whatever state you're in. And it's based on the West Key Number Classification System, which is used by lawyers, paralegals, and legal investigators nationwide. To give you an example, if a guy wanted to say, well, my lawyer didn't do something, the prosecutor didn't do something, and he looks up under the West Key Number System, you can use the word search or use the key number search, and it's all explained in the book. And you find that there was a case ruled on in Washington that says if a prosecutor withholds evidence knowingly, that's a denial of a fair trial. And you happen to be in Mississippi or in Florida or in Texas. When you get the topic and the key number of the case in Washington, you can look it up, that same topic and key number in your state. It's going to say, if that case has been ruled in your state like that, say the same thing. If you go to the federal system and find a case, it's going to say the same thing. If you go to the United States Supreme Court, it's going to say the same thing. And the reason why this is because you know yourself, 1963, there were three cases came out where the federal was saying like in post-conviction remedies and things like that, you have to, it was like under habeas corpus. They said the state's going to have to give state prisoners the same procedures as they give federal prisoners. Okay, so the states began to bring about rules and procedures how state prisoners can have procedures to get up in the state court. And it was all up under 2255 or 2254 for state prisoners. Well, that format was put in operation in all states. They call it under different statutes, under different rules for whatever state it applies for. It's like a questionnaire format. They ask you where you was convicted and stuff like that. And I have a form that I use myself in the book to show you how to answer the questions. And the reason why this is important because since 1986, 87, 96, wherever it was when Clinton was in and the ADPA came out, you only have 1 year after your conviction to get back into court. And like you said, somebody follow you around and telling you stuff, then you got more or less put your life in their hands.
Exactly.
Only thing this book does is says take your life, put it in your own hands.
Exactly.
And what you don't know can hurt you. So with the book, it gives you step by step. Do I need to get to the statute books? Tells you how to read the statute books. Do I need to get to the Corpus Juris Secundum? Do I need to read the Black's Law Dictionary? Do I need to read the state statutes? Do I need to read the case law books? Do I need to, you know, what do I need to do? This book tells you each step you can go through in order to get to the point where you can fill out the form. Once you fill out the form, you send it in. And one of the main things I suggest anybody do is ask for a lawyer, because post-conviction, you can ask for a lawyer, but the lawyer is not available to help you put the petition together.
In other words, you have to get it in court first before you get a lawyer.
Right. And that's the purpose the book serves, to help you get the petition together to go to court. And then say, give me a lawyer. Once you get the lawyer, you can tell them, say, hey, this is what I've done. This is what I found out. I found out there were certain documents I should have had at trial I didn't have. I have them now, because the book tells you how to get your own information. There was everything that happens on a federal level, the states find a procedure by which to do it on the state level, because all states have to follow the federal guidelines. There's a thing called the Freedom of Information Act on the federal level. There are also state laws where you can get information that was probably not available during trial. Maybe your lawyer didn't have the time to do it. Maybe your lawyer didn't have the inclination to do it. Maybe your lawyer didn't know it existed. Maybe you weren't able to explain it to your lawyer at that time, I need this information. Or maybe you didn't even know it existed. But if you do your research and you start going over your case yourself, because you can spend more time than any lawyer can, and you go over your case, you can say, okay, this is the stuff I need, and you can write off and get it yourself.
And you could be of much more help to your lawyer if you understand that what, you know, the things that's required. A lot of times, these lawyers they give you, they don't know things. They don't know everything.
Right.
You know, and you go in there and just dump your case in their lap and expect for them to do what's supposed to be done. And they also working probably hundreds of other cases.
Right.
That doesn't give them much time to spend working on any one individual case. So people need to understand that they need to put that work in themselves if they can. You can help probably if you just know maybe 10% of the law, you can be more helpful to yourself than some lawyer that knows a whole lot more than you do.
Right.
Or thinks he knows a whole lot more than you do. But, you know, I equate a lot of these lawyers is given to people by the courts. They almost as bad as some of the jailhouse lawyers. You know, they just, a lot of them just want to get, probably maybe your best shot is with a jailhouse lawyer more right. so than with some of the paid attorney, I mean, or public defenders.
Right.
Because they just want to get you out of the way.
Right.
You know, they don't particularly care about the outcome of your case. And that's the main thing a lot of people in prison need to understand. Your best chances, my paralegal instructor taught me that your best chances of walking out of a jail cell is trying to get your charge dismissed before it even goes to court.
Right.
Your next best chance is at the trial. But after you've been convicted, it is particularly difficult to try to have that conviction overturned, because they done went through all of the procedures and the trouble of trying to get you convicted. And even when they know, a lot of times they convicted somebody wrongly, the judges in these courts, they are not willing to overturn those convictions.
Right.
So you have to be especially aware and polished up to be able to go in these courts and try to persuade somebody to have to overturn your conviction. You have to come with something that's really concrete.
Right.
You know, something that's really something that, you know, the courts have said is just 100% wrong.
Right.
You know, if there's any explanations or excuses that can be given, you know, they're going to believe what the prosecutors say, or they're going to believe whatever the state attorney general says. They're probably going to rule in his favor and not yours. You know, and you have to make sure that your lawyers know what they're doing when they go in there, because a lot of times a criminal defendant, he'll be blamed for something that his lawyer didn't do.
Exactly. And that's one thing I want to point out about the book, too. The book is not to turn the average prisoner into a jailhouse lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
It's only to make you more informed as to what's really happening to you in your life.
Exactly.
You know, we have women across the country that's been convicted. I saw on a post the other day, 17 years for a crime that she didn't commit. And
exactly.
I'm saying, like, well, if you knew if you know 17 years later she didn't commit the crime you say she did, how come you couldn't in the first 3 or 4 years find that out? Mm. You know, now there's evidence that's been somewhere all this time, and now I could say, okay, well, she wasn't guilty. But look what you've done to her, her children, her family. People loved her. You know, what about that? You know what? You know, and then like far as like compensation for being in. Yeah, the money helps, but what repair does it really do? Because you know, unless you've been in prison for an extended period of time, you really don't know what prison does to a person.
There's no amount of money that can compensate you
right
for spending a considerable portion out of your life in prison.
And I'm talking about just, you know, if a man or a woman goes in for a crime they have committed, the damage is maybe 75%. But for a person who's been there that protracted period of time for something they didn't do, there's no measure on that as to the damage been done to that person and to the people around them. And you come back later on and say, oh, our bad, we made a mistake, so it's all good now.
And there are so many people in prison nowadays who are actually innocent of their crimes.
Right.
I can remember a time years ago when we were in prison, somebody came up to you and they said, hey, man, I'm innocent of this charge and I didn't do it. You look at them, you say, yeah, right. And you didn't say nothing. But, man, when people come up to you and they tell you that now, you have to stop and scratch your head and say, man, hey, he may act because you don't know.
Right.
There's so many people in prison, they run them through there like they on assembly line or something. And, you know, if you don't catch all the texts and things that you have to, that you call out before they come in and they render that verdict, you know, a lot of times you're just not going to make it out of them places.
And, you know, and one of the other, like we talk about miscarriages, is like getting people to plead guilty for crimes they didn't commit. Or overcharge them so they can plead to a lesser crime, which in essence give them more time than they were probably entitled to. You know, and always the promise and the hope to them and their family, oh, you'll do 2 years and then you'll be out on parole. They'll let you back out. And you with a 15-year sentence, you're not going to get out in 2 years. I mean, but you're not knowing that you say, I did whatever you say I did, even though you didn't do it. You know, and in this book, what we try to do in the book is show you, like, hey, all hope is not lost. The only time hope is lost when you give it up, give it all up.
Exactly.
And the reason why you give up hope, because you don't see a glimmer of light anything. But when there is an opportunity for you to do something for yourself, then you start saying, okay, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can do this, you know. And this book, After Conviction, What You Can Do Before Your Lawyer Is Appointed, it's available nationwide for anybody that need it. Man, woman, don't make no difference. Get one for yourself. Get one for your loved one who's locked up.
Okay, do they contact to get the book, and how do you go about acquiring it?
The book is available from IFA Legal Services. That's IFAA, Post Office Box, IFA Legal Services, IFAA Legal Services, Post Office Box, 300-952. Kansas City, Missouri, 64130. Also, recently, through some other connections I've been able to get, the book is available on Amazon now. Mm-hmm. Amazon Books, yeah. And the book costs $25.
Well, I certainly thank you for your contribution in this area, because every little bit helps. We, you know, this system that we're trying to fight is turned into a monster. It's always been a monster.
Right.
You know, but there are people like yourself and other organizations out here that's
right,
working for change, and they are having an impact on the corruption that takes place in the criminal justice system. So I want to thank you, and I wish we had more time to deal with this, but maybe we can get you back at some other time again and you can give us some more insight.
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity to come in, and I'm hoping that, you know, somebody used the book and it helps them, you know, because that's really what it's all about. I heard a long time ago, you know, you reach one and you teach one.
Exactly.
You know, and when you teach, you learn, and when you learn, you teach.
All right. And yes, thank you very much for
thank you for having
challenges.
Me.
Now the calendar for the week of December 17th. Survivors Unite is uniting families who have lost a loved one to violent crime. They understand that grief is experienced in different stages and help families heal and learn to properly release their emotions. Survivors United meets every third Monday of the month and will meet Monday, December 17th, 7 p.m. at Margaret's Place, 7217 Troost, Kansas City, Missouri. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for Rehabilitation of Errants will have their monthly meeting Monday, December 17th, 6:30 p.m. at Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Missouri Cure advocates for prisoners' human rights and family involvement in rehabilitation and reintegration into society. CORI's network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. The next workshop, Orientation for Those Who Want to Volunteer with CORI's Network, will be held Monday, December 17th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Kansas City, Missouri. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Noland Road. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161 or email corysnetwork@gmail.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Mothers in Charge Healing Support Group will be meeting Thursday, December 20 from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center, Suite 124 West, 3200 Wayne Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. This group is for people who have lost loved ones to murder and violence. The first hour will be sharing of experiences, and in the second hour, therapists and others who can help navigate the emotional and legal terrain will be available. For more information, you can find them on the web at kcmothersincharge.org or call them at 816-912-2601. My name is Teresa Wilkie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now we go to Melvin and his guest.
Good morning, Kansas City. Welcome to a live edition of Jaws of Justice. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt. In the studio with me is Dr. Martin Hinn. He has a PhD in philosophy, a master's in classic from the University of Kansas. He has published significant work in the areas of
pre-Socratic.
All right. Good for me. And he has written a book entitled Under the Color of Law.
Yes, sir.
And the first thing I want to say is welcome to Jaws of Justice, Doctor.
Well, thank you, Melvin. Thank you for having me on the Jaws today. I do appreciate it.
Sure. Now, tell us why the title of this book is called Under the Color of Law.
Well, actually, Melvin, yeah, that's a phrase contained in the federal anti-torture statute. And in that statute, and I'll just read it, it says torture means an act committed by a person acting under the color of law, specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering other than pain or suffering incidental to lawful sanctions upon another person within his custody or physical control. So the law actually envisions a case where a government official might wish to commit a torture or institute a policy of torture and giving it the right coloring of law. The book that we're looking at today is a sort of a dialectical refutation of the Bush Administration Office of Legal Counsel's main arguments that are and represent the architecture of the Bush counterterrorist strategy. So what I do in the book is it's all dialectical. I let the administration state their positions and defend them, and then I offer a barrage of objections to those views.
Bush was given, we talked about this earlier, mm-hmm. Bush was given like a carte blanche card.
Oh, absolutely.
To do whatever he will. This is, and it spilled right over into the Obama era as well.
Right.
And so they just had a free road, for lack of a better word, to do as they will with the Taliban and the what was the other one?
The Al Qaeda.
The Al Qaeda.
Right.
During that time. So.
Right. So the first thing they did though was they took that and then expanded it even further. So the very first thing, the very first document we look at, and the book's all centered around a set of questions. For example, so question one concerns: does the president have constitutional power to initiate a foreign war without congressional authorization? Well, there's a yes side and a no side. The administration's going to take the yes side. I'm going to take the
Absolutely.
No side. So the first thing they did, and I'll just, this is the book here, failing to notice as, and this is position one for the Bush administration, mm-hmm. and these are the beginning of my objections to those positions. So failing to notice as a principle, as a fundamental principle of law, that suspects are to be distinguished from criminals, the latter having been found guilty through due process of law, Deputy Assistant Attorney General John C. Yu claims ill-advisedly that, quote, the president has constitutional power not only to retaliate against any person, organization, or state suspected of involvement in terrorist attacks on the United States, but also against foreign states suspected of harboring or supporting such organizations. Now, this is crucial. This is setting out a doctrine of immediate and extrajudicial retaliation, wherein suspects in the war on terror came to be regarded as suitable objects of physical punishment in the field. This leapfrogs over two serious legal processes. One, the gathering of intelligence information on the ground, if it's Al-Qaeda, or information in a criminal case, if it's a criminal case, but also the collection of evidence leading to discovery of facts grounding the case. And then secondly, the judicial process itself, where you have legal counsel, you have a trial process under the Geneva Conventions. There's an Article 5 tribunal that all suspected terrorists would be gone through. That whole process was short-circuited, and we've leapfrogged over these processes. So suspects are never proper objects of retaliation under the rule of law as conceived, Melvin, in both Roman and Anglo-American traditions of jurisprudence, because such retaliation would negate any presumption of innocence on behalf of those held suspect. And I argue in the book that it's really this early confusion of suspect behavior for criminal behavior so soon after 9/11 that was the very Archimedean point from which the Bush administration Office of Legal Counsel
carried over.
Then sought to undermine and systematically remove the terra firma of international humanitarian protection from those it labeled unlawful enemy combatants. So had the administration, Melvin, followed military tradition, a thorough investigation leading to mandatory Article 5 hearings over each detainee's suspected role as an enemy combatant, as opposed to the mere fact of his detention in U.S. custody, would have determined the POW status of each captive case by case. So my point, though, and this is why I'm on the show today, is that this whole policy bleeds into law enforcement. So as
Sure.
these policies filter down through the intelligence and law enforcement community, the horizon of the definition of suspect itself begins to broaden. And if you look at Priest and Arkin in the book Top Secret America, I'm going to quote here. This is Priest and Arkin. Quote, the federal government defines a suspicious activity in a fairly loose way as, quote, observed behavior reasonably indicative of pre-operational planning related to terrorism, and this is the big phrase, or other criminal activity. Other criminal activity. So this is talking about the Guardian program, which is an information sharing program between the FBI in Washington and local law enforcement on the ground. So Priest and Arkin go on, they say, in fact, the very effectiveness of this Guardian database that they're talking about, where there's this sharing of information between local police and FBI in real time on American citizens based on a flash of a license plate and the collection of this metadata in real time, it depends on collecting the identities of people who are not known criminals or terrorists and on being able to quickly compile in-depth profiles of them based on all of this metadata on the theory that someday, Melvin, in the future, a nugget of information will come forward that will clarify whether this person is or is not a threat. So, yeah.
So in essence, so that this spilled right over into the communities, you know, with
right.
that mindset, the way that they looked at the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban's and all of this thing that was happening from September 11th. And so now the law is covering even those people
look,
that are in
right. So look how policing is going on. Now all of this metadata, and that metadata is all of our digital communication, our texts, our tweets, our this, our that, telephonic communications, emails, all of it digital, right? All of that metadata is used to build suspicion. Now the relationship between police officer and citizen is a relationship that's predicated on massive amounts of information that is doing what? Building suspicion. And right. What is the original foundation of this policy? That suspects are worthy objects of retaliation. Mm. That's the word of the text. That's why I'm on the show today. So John Yoo kicks in the door to the Constitution, which I was like appalled about, so I wrote a book about it. And then as it filters down through the through sort of the deep state intelligence complex, including law enforcement, the horizon of the concept of suspect then becomes broadened beyond just suspicion of possible terrorism to suspicion of possible anything. So if we have this relationship between law enforcement and citizens predicated on endless suspicion, it's going to ramp up the pace of that contact. It's going to infect that contact with all kinds of negativity. It's spilling back over into society.
So, according to you, memorandum that what he wrote, that certain suspects didn't have the privilege of the process of the law.
Right.
And as you wrote here in your book, quoting him, Yoo's statement fails to acknowledge the key fact that due process requires that we assume as not guilty unless proven otherwise.
Right.
So a lot of that did not apply
right
to the Taliban's or the and then after that it spilled over into the American streets as it relate to the law.
Right. And the reason you don't suspend due process to Bin Laden or to these terrorists is because that due process is our tradition, Melvin. It's our, you and I. That's our tradition. That's not their tradition.
Right.
Do the terrorists morally deserve it? Probably not, but that's beside the point. You apply the process of law to every case, citizen or not. There is an old strain of thought in judicial thought that goes back in American history to Joseph Story, who was an appointee under James Madison. And it's a strong belief that I have, I mean, it's in my blood, that the Constitution extends through the operation of U.S. nationals overseas, here at home, wherever those officials are operating, our Constitution extends through that operation. But one thing, the other reason I came on the show was there's this other concept, and this is major, and this is really the kind of the eye-opener. So all of this flying in the face of tradition. Well, what do we call that tradition? Well, law calls that tradition customary international law. So today there are really two concepts. There's statutory or positive international law, Melvin, and that's the Geneva Conventions, that's treaties on paper that have been ratified and so forth. Then we have customary international law. And in the book, I define customary international law as that part of law signifying a body of de facto customs, usages, and practices shared in common, Melvin, among the many peoples of the earth. Customary international law is therefore distinct from positive international law, or what is often called treaty law. Now, the Bush administration office of legal counsel position is that customary international law has no binding legal effect on the president in his conduct of the Afghanistan conflict and counterterrorism because it is not federal treaty law. And this is why I wanted to come on the show. John Yoo and his cohort, Jack Goldsmith, have argued in publications that go back to the late 90s that here's the argument the Federalist Society makes. They say that, well, this customary international law, which is written, Melvin, it's written in the texts of Hugo Grotius. He was a Dutch jurist who published a major treatise in 1625. Alberico Gentilis, an independent Italian who published a treatise on international law in 1612. Balthazar Ayala, a Belgian who published a foundational treatise on international law in 1582. You have Francisco de Vitoria, whose publications reach print in 1696. Just those four have written books that outline and contain those principles of our legal tradition.
You know, as I was reading some of your book, and it kind of reminded me back in World War II. I wasn't in that year, but from my own study and looking at it, it almost lines up when you and Hayes, too, had wrote this, and it's almost like, you know, it was a Hitler. It just threw out everything in terms of the Geneva Convention, and we started acting like what Hitler saw, that he wasn't under the Geneva Convention.
Right.
And so this is how, even in your book, in position one, it says, on request at the General Counsel Hayes to be informed as to whether or not the laws govern armed conflict, including international treaties and federal laws, apply to conditions of detainees or detention and procedures for trial of suspect members of Al-Qaeda and Taliban. Deputy Assistant Yu sets forth the position. And so with that position that they had set forth, that none of that stuff applied as it relate to September 11th.
Right. So what question three deals with is the question of whether customary international law acknowledges Bush 2 Office of Legal Counsel failed state doctrine. And of course, what I find in the book is there's actually strong evidence in the tradition against this idea of a failed state. States don't fail simply because we don't like their government. But this failed state argument was used as a pretext to say, okay, well, Afghanistan under the Taliban is a failed state, therefore Afghanistan's not a state, therefore they're not a party to Geneva, therefore the Geneva Conventions don't apply to captives taken in the zone of Afghanistan.
The key word is failed state.
Right. And again, it's a fiction. There is no such thing. But here's what Grotius says. He says that Grotius says Augustine corrects Cicero's opinion in saying, quote, neither shall I affirm that a people is not a people, nor a state, so long as there remains the union of a rational multitude associated in harmonious community for the things they love, unquote. Grotius goes on, and Hugo Grotius is the father of modern international law, so he is the legal community, those that are aware of him, would know this. The whole point is the Bush administration and the Federalist Society lawyers, you and Goldsmith, are arguing that this tradition is outside of federal law, yet here's the argument, it is in federal law because it's contained in the text of the Geneva Conventions. It's Geneva 3, Article 142, Paragraph 4, and it says in that article, it actually says here, for those countries that would denounce the Geneva Conventions, by meaning find a legal process outside of the Geneva Conventions to formally denounce the treaty, to withdraw from it, they have effect. This denunciation has effect only in respect of the denouncing power. It shall in no way, Geneva says, impair the obligations which the parties to the conflict shall remain bound to fulfill by virtue of the principles of the law of nations, the jus gentium, as they result from the usages established among civilized peoples for the laws of humanity and the dictates of the public conscience. And the reason this is important, Melvin, is that in the tradition, which I read, I look at the ancient languages. That's why I was able to write this book. I'm going back in and looking at what these texts are saying. There is a huge consensus among Western philosophers and historians. This consensus in legal concepts that you have diplomatic immunity, rights of post limine, all of these things we take for granted as diplomatic law, is founded on thousands and thousands of years of human civilized development over time. And so to throw that tradition out, to say it's not part of law, it doesn't restrict us, you're literally severing yourself from your own tradition. That's why it's important.
You alluded to the fact that, you know, how they maybe even record your license plate. So I was wondering, for the layperson like myself and those that are listening, kind of tie that in to what we're talking about with this this law that they have created strictly for Taliban and and basically Afghanistan and that failed state, and how did that spill over? Because you made mention of that it's now into the police department as well.
Right.
So help us to wrap our minds around how this tie in to the laws that we actually are under right. in the United States.
Well, right. So as John, you kicks in the door on the Constitution, elements of law enforcement, elements in the deep state are beginning to then unhinge that door completely off of the foundations of the House. Mm-hmm. So the problem is that these are just a continued attempt to maximize power, to collect total intelligence on the population. There's a fellow with a new book out, Bernard Harcourt. I think he calls it the counter-revolution. How the American government went to war against its own people. He's arguing that what's going on right now, and he's absolutely correct, is this is a conscious effort of counterinsurgency policy being essentially undertaken by the federal government against the American people. So, and he's exactly right. That is the continuation of the momentum of these policies. But ultimately, what it's going to come down to, how do we turn this back? Ultimately, it's going to come down to an assertion of basic political rights. And we really need to get back to, you know, reforming the democracy that we have. And that would ultimately mean some fundamental constitutional reform. That's ultimately, how did we get here? How do we stay in this mess? Well, I mean, we've got a government that's bought and paid for by big money. That's got to be turned back. We've got a media in control of corporate outlets. Under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, mega corporations can just snatch up parts of the media willy-nilly. 100 years ago, it was a scandal in 1915 that the J.P. Morgan Associates, the powder, steel, and shipbuilding interests, actually conspired to take over the political editorships of 25 of the major newspapers in the United States. They actually did. The plot was broken. It was actually revealed by Oscar Calloway on the floor of the House of Representatives. And that was a scandal 100 years ago. Under the Telecommunications Act, that whole process is perfectly legal and above board. So until we can gain back the narrative that's been captured and conquered from us, until we can gain back a media that actually allows people like myself and others to actually talk about these issues in a way that's constructive, we're never going to get anywhere. And ultimately, I said I was a retired professor. I was retired passive because 6 days after I was lecturing on preemption in 2007 at a university, a research university. And I argued that we have no right under classical international law to launch, whether it be with Israel or other sets of allies, any kind of military attack on Iran under the presumption that they're building a program that could, if left under out of control, present a threat to the Middle East. It's illegal under the law. So I argued that, was handed a letter of severance 6 days later. And that was 11 years ago. So I did manage to go on and find other work, but eventually it just sort of petered out. So we don't have a society that's open enough to say, wow, look at this guy. I mean, he wrote this great book. Come on down. You know, let's study this. No, I was shunted off, Melvin. And that's, sure. You know, that's where we're at.
Remember, Kansas City, if you're just not tuning in, you're tuned in to Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1. I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and in the studio with me is Dr. Hen, Martin Hen, and he's my guest. He's written a book called Under the Color of Law, and this is what we're talking about. And so we were trying to wrap our minds around how this ties into our laws today with the Flanagan and you memorandum that they've written. And as he alluded to the fact that he kicked the door open and allowed the president to Bush and was able to just about do whatever he wanted as he saw fit, and pertaining to the September 11th attack on the Trade Center. So this is what we're talking about, and for us lay people, he's trying to lay it into us about understanding what these laws are all about and how it affects us today. And those laws are still in place right today.
Absolutely.
And it hasn't changed. Right. And so this is what we're talking about. And go ahead, Doctor, tell us a little bit more about how that actually operates on the streets as it relates to the law enforcement. This is why I want to keep going back to that.
Right. So, Well, I mean, again, though, to go at this idea that suspects are worthy objects of punishment, again, that punishment comes at the very end of the legal process, after due process has been applied, after a sentence has been levied, and that's kind of the system that we're supposed to have. But the system we actually have has really been tarnished quite a bit by this policy of counterterrorism. So we have a police that is highly militarized now, that routinely goes to Israel to train. Well, this is just not really something that I find very productive. It's not gonna foster the kind of peaceful relationships that police really need to be having with the citizenry. So again, it's this err on the side of excessive militarism, err on the side of having police that are massive crowd control forces. This is just not the direction of a free people, in my view. But you're asking good questions. I want to say this, though. If you were to read my book, there you get the architecture of the Bush policies and why they're wrong. And the two books that I would recommend would be that Dana Priest, William Arkin, Top Secret America, The Rise of the New American Security State, in order to see where these policies then mushroomed out from, what they turned into. And then finally, the WikiLeaks file. And this was released in a book in 2015, The WikiLeaks Files, The World According to U.S. Empire. That's going to show you how we operate overseas through diplomatic channels to affect and to involve ourselves, I think, illegally in the internal domestic politics of other countries, often to the detriment of the majority of the people of those countries.
Thank you, Dr. Hinn. Dr. Martin Hinn has been my guest, and we were talking about Under the Color of Law, and you have an opportunity real quick, just in case someone is interested in possibly purchasing your book. You have any information that you want to throw?
Well, I mean, I would go maybe bnn.com. Go on there. Under the Color of Law, that should pop up. That's a good way to get it. I'd go on Marketplace, see if you can find it used. But outside of that, I don't, there's no special avenue to other than just kind of going online and, pointing and clicking and purchasing it.
Thank you, Dr. Martin Hinn, for being my guest here on Jaws of Justice.
Absolutely.
Right here on KKFI 90.1.
420 Drug War News. I want to read a little bit from a book we're going to speak to one of the co-authors about here in just a moment. Quote, "The role of the press in creating national hysteria around pop stars and drugs cannot be overestimated. If the American war on drugs was at least in part manufactured to satisfy racial prejudice, then its British franchise was at least in part manufactured to sell papers." And with that, I want to bring on our guest. He's a co-author of Drug Wars, the terrifying inside story of Britain's drug trade. And with that, I want to welcome J.S. Raphael. Hello, sir.
Hi there, Dean. Nice to be on. Thank you for having me.
But you co-authored this with Mr. Neil Woods. I think he was now the former president of Leap UK. Is that correct?
Neil is the current chairman of Leap UK.
Chairman, okay.
So Neil worked for 15 years as an undercover drugs cop.
Right.
And bases his experience and his expertise on that frontline service on the war on drugs, and based his ethical decision that the war on drugs is a sort of vast and hideous policy error on his experience.
Well, and I think many of us that worked in law enforcement, I don't know if you know, J.S., I was a cop as well back in the 60s. And
I didn't, right. Okay.
We all tend to look back on it and see some errors of our ways in so doing. But this book, I want to first off just thank you. You've educated me. I feel proud. This spring I went to Portugal and to Switzerland to learn from some of their experts, but I learned some things about the drug war for Great Britain, for the UK, that I just had no idea of how this escalated, that's what much of your book talks about, is that there was a problem. But it's nothing like we have today, correct?
Well, it's very kind of you to say. Thank you. And it was, and funnily enough, a lot of what comes out in the book was news to me as well. I had worked in this in the drugs field. I'd written quite a lot about it for several years. But when we undertook the research for the book, it really opened my eyes to specifically just how tiny an issue this was in the UK.
Again, the guest is J.S. Raffaele. He's co-author with Neil Woods, the chairman of the board of Law Enforcement Action Partnership in the UK. Name of the book, Drug Wars, The Terrifying Inside Story of Britain's Drug Trade. I highly recommend it. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.